listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, Taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Jeff Dice with me once again. And he's been on the show many times in the past, so you would know him as the former chief of staff to Congressman Ron Paul. But more recently, in the last few years since Ron left the Congress, Jeff is now the president of the Mises Institute and doing, I think, a very spectacular job. I've been to a couple of his events, and he just does such a great job in presenting and discussing various topics, so I'm really pleased to have him back with us again here. Thanks for joining me again, Jeff.
Hello, Jay. Good to talk to you.
Always good to have you with me. You know, I've titled today's show, How Much Longer Can Guns and Butter Diplomacy Last? And then you and I had a little email back and forth this morning, and you mentioned that Ron Paul has recently written an article, The Dollar Dilemma, or I think you mentioned you took it from a speech. The title of his speech was The Dollar Dilemma, Where To From Here? I would like to start out just by reading a quote from Ron Paul in that article. He said, and I quote, "It's a fallacy to believe the U.S. has a free market economy. The economy is run by a conglomerate of individuals and special interests in and out of government, including the deep state, which controls central economic planning." Now, Jeff, you know, when people talk about the deep state, many people scoff at the notion of conspiracy. But as an advisor to Ron Paul, you most certainly had a front row seat to what's going on in Washington. Can you help our listeners get a sense of how the so-called deep state works on Capitol Hill to destroy?
Sure. The deep state isn't deep or hidden. It's right in front of us. It's the administrative agencies, all the various departments and the alphabet soup agencies that are part of them. It's been growing. It grew exponentially throughout the 20th century. And we all know these Department of Agriculture, Department of Defense, Homeland Security, et cetera, et cetera. So there's nothing deep about it. The only thing deep is that there are lots and lots of people who work for those agencies, millions actually, who belong to federal unions and don't come and go with various administrations and have their own agendas and don't much care who the president is or who the cabinet secretary is, and pursue things as they wish. And we've seen this many, many times. It's impossible for the president or his cabinet members or even all of Congress with all of their committees and their oversight. It's impossible for all these people to know day to day what's really happening in the administrative agencies, like the Department of Education, for example. So as a result, they've run amok with their own agenda. That's what bureaucracies do. And there's nothing conspiratorial about this. It's just the nature of bureaucracies. So what we've got is a bunch of people who have a lot of power but who aren't voted into office and don't come and go every 4 years. So it's a terrible situation, and it's caused the federal government to become largely unaccountable to the average guy or gal, because your only recourse against administrative overreach, is to sue them in federal court, which is great if you're Mark Cuban and you've got 10 years and a few million dollars for lawyer fees to try to salvage your reputation against the SEC in his case. But for the average person, that's not a viable remedy. So they are, in effect, again, no conspiracy, but they are, in effect, lawless federal agencies. And they do what they want to do, and there's not much you or I could do about it if, for example, the EPA comes onto our farm and says, you got to divert this river. And that's just a fact.
Yeah, and what they're doing, of course, is really messing up with the free market. I mean, they're not allowing the markets to work freely. They are passing laws, or not even passing laws. They don't go to that trouble. As you point out, they have this enormous power to just simply declare new regulations, right?
Well, Congress doesn't have the expertise to govern all the things it wants to govern. Yeah. You could never write laws that could imagine every possible what if or every possible factual scenario. So as a result, the people at the administrative agency have an awful lot of power to either color it between the lines by drafting regulations or just interpreting the statutes and the regulations in the way that they see fit. So really, Congress, you know, imagine trying to pass a law that would deal with everything foreseeable in land and water usage in the West. It's impossible. So we've given administrative agencies the task of filling in the gaps, and they've taken that task up quite greedily. And as a result, we're in a mess, and even Trump can't do much about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, you know, you mentioned the agricultural agency, but Ron names four powerful agencies in his article that can secretly do almost anything they wish to protect the monetary elites. So, in other words, I think from the perspective of the economy overall, it's my impression that Ron would suggest that some of these agencies are probably more powerful and hence more destructive to the free markets than others. Would you care to comment on that? I think he mentioned the Fed, the Treasury, the SEC, the Commodities Futures Trading Commission were the ones I believe he mentioned in his article.
Well, sure, because no matter almost any business practice you're involved in, you want to raise capital. And if you want to become a public company or if you want to deal in commodities, you're going to have to deal with these regulatory agencies. So they're very, very powerful. But their power pales in comparison to the Fed. We have to understand that the Fed, in effect, not directly, but indirectly, controls the value of dollars, can make them worth more or less relative to other currencies and relative to goods and services. And it also controls the price, the cost of those dollars. In other words, interest rate is the price you pay, the cost of borrowing money. So basically half of every transaction is not governed by market principles. When you go buy a Honda Accord, you're studying the quality of the car, but is Honda studying the quality of the dollar that you're exchanging for it? So when we say we have a free market economy in this country, we have to start with the premise that, well, half of it almost by definition isn't free because it involves payment in dollars, which are ultimately controlled by a central planning agency, which is in practice and in theory no different than having the federal government control wheat or auto worker wages, or you know, how many barns should be built this year. Things that Soviet planners and Soviet commissars used to do, and which we would screech at rightfully as Soviet, mm-hmm. as central planning. But that's exactly what we do with one half of our economy, which is the dollar that mm-hmm. we're buying goods and services with.
Well, Ron refers to the dollar as fake money. Could you explain what he means by fake money and what would be non-fake money?
Well, paper money used to be a certificate. It used to be a certificate for which you could redeem in actual gold or silver. And the reason paper money arose is because in order to do business in a rational way, it was awfully difficult to literally carry around bags of gold and silver coins and try to make change and all that. So we came up with money substitutes in the form of nice, lightweight, transportable paper, but it was never intended to be money. And if you look at early U.S. dollars, they even say redeemable for an actual dollar. The dollar bill was just a certificate to go get that, sort of like a claim check you would get at the opera for your coat or something. So when the link between the U.S. dollar and gold was severed, first in the 1930s, when U.S. citizens were no longer able to redeem U.S. dollars, paper dollars, for physical gold. And then finally, ultimately, in 1971, when foreign governments, central banks, foreign actors, etc., were no longer able to redeem U.S. dollars for physical gold, then at that point, there was no longer any connection between the underlying what we would call commodity money and the dollar itself. So it became fake in the sense that it's like monopoly money. You can just produce it at almost zero cost, and yet magically this thing that you hold in your hand, paper, is supposed to be worth exchanging for actual stuff, you know, physical goods and services. So that's what he means by fake in that context.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly then that fake money can be created infinitely by the Federal Reserve, which I guess really makes it the most powerful of those agencies that you're talking about. But endless amounts of money can be created. Since 1971, it allowed the United States to set up a dollar-based system, really backed by petroleum. It was a petrodollar system. In his article, though, Ron mentions that there are some threats to the existing dollar system. Would you care to talk a little bit about what might be threatening the U.S. dollar right now?
Well, there's no question. The number one threat is congressional spending, deficit spending. The rest of the world can take a look at us and say, you know, these guys always spend way more than they bring in taxes. And they use this money to fund wars. They meddle around the world. They build aircraft carriers and jets and all kinds of things. And yet they still have this big entitlement structure at home. And they're never going to get their fiscal house in order. So even though since the Bretton Woods Agreement and because of the Bretton Woods Agreement, because of the petrodollar arrangement, we have to have dollars to clear national transactions, to buy oil, to do all kinds of things in the world economy, you know, we're worried because the people issuing them are so profligate, they don't have their own fiscal house in order. So it's I think the biggest threat to the dollar is that the rest of the world knows that we are never, ever, ever going to stop spending beyond our means unless we're forced to. And so that's why I think cracks are showing. That's why I think there's an interest, especially in the eastern half of the planet, in physical gold and holding gold again. And that's why I think there's an interest in cryptocurrencies, because people don't have a lot of faith in Western governments, and especially the American government, to control their currencies. They know, based on history and based on our temperament, that when things go wrong, we'll just crank up the money machine. That's what we'll do. That's what we did in 2008 when the stock market crisis hit. So they're being entirely rational in the world. The economy is being entirely rational in trying to find ways to hedge against the day when or if the dollar starts to fall.
Yeah. Of course, you and I see that. Ron Paul sees it. People that follow Austrian economics are aware of it. But I dare say that most PhDs in economics that come out of Princeton, Harvard, and Yale are oblivious to this. It seems to me they're almost indoctrinated not to see this obvious logical relationships that you're talking about. And Ron mentions that rigging the economy, and I'm quoting him here, he says, rigging the economy is required to prevent market forces from demanding a halt to the mistakes that planners continuously make. This deceptive policy can last only for a limited time. Ultimately, the market forces proves more powerful than government manipulation of economic events. And he mentions in the article things like the consumer price index is manipulated. It's clearly it's something we've talked about on the show frequently. Putting a ceiling on the price of gold. He mentions that the certain interests are controlling and manipulating the price of gold. That's another topic we've talked about on this show as well, through the massive paper futures markets. I think more gold is traded on paper than is mined in an entire year. Than in one day, more gold is traded in paper than mined in an entire year. And of course, the biggest one I think is the suppression of interest rates, which is really not allowing price discovery for capital, the cost of money, if you will, as you alluded to it earlier. But why? How can, you know, the point is that people, the wool is pulled over people's eyes. So they say the consumer price index is only 2% or something like that, when in fact it's probably 6 or 8%. What is going to cause the cracks you're mentioning are cracks in the global economy, in the markets and so forth. Where is the breaking point? What is the tipping point that will cause this whole thing to, you know, for people to finally wake up and rebel against this fake money?
Well, in the short term, let's say we have another stock market crash or another commercial real estate crash, which I think we're ripe for, or a housing crash or all kinds of things. And I don't just mean in America alone, but in the West. Yeah. I think in the very short term, that actually strengthens the dollar because just like in 2008, it's perceived as the least dirty shirt in the laundry. And while there's some flight into probably precious metals and commodities in the event of a crash, there's also some flight into dollars as the rest of the world says, gee whiz, what should we do? But I think what happens long term is that the people who buy U.S. Treasury debt, including the Fed, including the Social Security Pension Fund, including to a lessening extent some Asian central banks, just say no mas. And, you know, the lie is finally exposed when the only real market for U.S. Treasuries is our own Fed. The right. lie has already been exposed in Japan, where the Bank of Japan is actually buying Japanese public companies' equities and holding those on their balance sheets to prop them up. So nobody's kidding themselves anymore what that process really means. It's state capitalism writ large. And how does that look? I mean, that's just it. We can't know. We can't know if it looks like a bubble that pops and there's a lot of really, really unpleasant economic fallout right away, or if it's something that just slowly over 50 or 100 years unwinds. I mean, we might look at the UK and say, mm-hmm. as an economic power, England probably peaked about 100 years ago at the beginning of World War One, mm-hmm. and it's been all downhill ever since in terms of its superpower status. That said, 100 years later, England and the UK are still a better place to live than much of the world. They're still Western first world places. Mm-hmm. So we can't always assume that the world is going to look like Mad Max.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that we could be a lot more prosperous and we could be a lot more stable and secure with respect to the future, no matter what happens. Even if we stay relatively rich compared to the rest of the world, that is alone is not the issue. The issue is what could have been, what we might have had if we had any kind of rational fiscal policy in terms of Congress not creating more and more debt every year, some sort of rational monetary policy, and most of all, actual, real, live interest rates, paying people to save money mm-hmm. and accumulate capital, which, frankly, people under 50 in this country don't even remember.
Yeah.
These newly minted PhDs, brilliant as they are like jet fighter pilots who are technically proficient, but they've never flown the jet in bad weather or nighttime. Mm-hmm. It's really a bizarro world when we disconnect interest rates from saving. And if we're not saving money, if we're not accumulating capital, then we are expressly devouring the civilization that our grandparents and great grandparents bequeathed to us. And we're basically shrugging and giving up and saying, I'm going to live today at the expense of tomorrow.
Jeff, with just about a minute and a half left, can you explain why gold is so important in returning us back to a free market system?
Well, some kind of real money is going to have to emerge when fiat currencies go the way of the dodo bird. We don't know that it will be gold. It could be cryptos. It could be other things. It could be silver. But what we do know is gold has never, ever become worthless in the history of man. You can, as Ron mentions in his article, you can dig up an old Spanish ship and find a bunch of gold galleons on it from hundreds of years ago. And they're still worth a lot of money today. So, its durability and the fact that humans have always valued it weighs strongly in its favor, that it will continue to be a form of money, whether it's banned by governments or not, and that if there's a crash or a crisis, it'll become the form of money.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's an article that I think people listening to this show would do well to read. And Jeff, they can pick it up, I think, at the Mises website, right? And where do they go for that?
Mises.org. At Mises.org. It's posted there. It's also posted at the LouRockwell.com website.
And you have a weekly interview as well that's posted at Mises. Do you know who your guest is going to be this coming weekend?
Yeah, this week we're talking to a great Spanish economist named Daniel Lacalle. He's really great on all things Europe. And if you want to keep up with the show, just follow me on Twitter at Jeff Deist, JeffDeist.
That's fabulous, Jeff. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look to do it again sometime in the near future, I hope.
Okay.
All right, folks. Well, that is all the time we have for this week. Next week, I expect to have Richard Mayberry with me. This time, I hope to discuss how trade wars increase the likelihood of hot wars, as well as other related topics. Until then, goodbye, and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Montera Resources, an advanced exploration company, is aggressively expanding its high-grade Gladiator gold deposit in Quebec, Canada. Over the last 12 months, Bonterra has raised over $60 million and has attracted strategic investors Eric Sprott, Kirkland Lake Gold, and New York-based Vanek Gold Fund. Bonterra is focused on updating its 43-101 resource in the second half of 2018 and will incorporate up to an additional 100,000 meters of drilling, where the dimensions of the Gladiator deposit have been expanded to date nearly 500%. Bonterra trades in Canada under the symbol BTR and in the U.S. under the symbol BONXF.
Auren Resources is a technically driven, capital-efficient exploration company focused on delivering shareholder value through accretive project acquisition and discovery. The company's management team has a record of success in the discovery, advancement, and monetization of exploration assets. Auren's focus is on advancing its seven premier gold exploration projects located in Canada and Peru. Auren's shares trade on the TSX in Canada and the NYSE American in the U.S. under the stock symbol AUG. For more information, please visit AurenResources.com.